Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley here. We got Graham Parker on the program today. I'm so happy this worked out. This is a guy I've been listening to a long time. You know, in those days of, I don't know, 1976, 77, when everybody I knew, not everybody I knew, but like a good portion of my high school was, for some reason, listening to The Doors, you know, a band that didn't exist anymore. And so it was a breath of fresh air when records like Elvis Costello's first record or Joe Jackson's or The Cars or all these debuts of bands that were so different from Journey and Styx and that kind of junk, which I just didn't relate to. And then folks like Graham Parker, it was just something that I related to better. And so listening to this guy for a long time, he's back on tour with his original band, The Rumor. And just a lot of energy, one of those kind of good guests where I don't really do much. I just, you know, ask him, if you listen, really, I only ask him about five questions in the whole interview, and he just takes the ball and runs with it. So makes it easy. That's about it. I haven't seen the Brian Wilson movie. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And so far, guests, listeners seem to be telling me that they like it. So I had such low expectations, and now I'm thrilled. It's probably going to be good. That has nothing to do with Graham Parker. Nevertheless, let's hear this Graham Parker interview. I will talk to you soon. Thanks. Graham Parker, welcome to WFMU. Good morning. You've got the new record out called Mystery Glue, and you are in the middle of a tour tomorrow and Monday at City Winery, and then Cleveland, Long Island, Tarrytown, right here, the Highline Ballroom in New York City next Saturday, the 13th, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Newton, New Jersey. And then October to the UK, you're back with The Rumor. I mean, it's. I assume you still love doing this. Is that a correct assumption?
It's actually pretty exciting to be with this band because they're so good. And, it's one of those things where if the demand is there, then you tend to listen to your agents. The next thing you know, the ball is rolling. And there it is. It's like this... This cyclical thing that just keeps popping up. So we do it while we're all standing and breathing, right? We might as well have a go at it. And the gigs, it's always the same with The Rumor. There's just always extraordinary musicianship popping out all around me on stage. And I love playing solo. I love, I did some duo stuff with Brinsley on tour in the UK recently. But... the band thing, this was the band we started, in 1976, same guys. So we've got that certain, as I call it, mystery glue that makes us work pretty well.
Yeah, the new record's called Mystery Glue, and I was reading some of the literature, and you sort of describe it as the mysterious force that holds the entire universe together, or music, sort of.
I'm being facetious, of course. Yes, I do like to have a laugh. Some people take it too seriously, but finding the title was difficult because none of the song titles leapt out at me as being an album title, and these words "Mystery Glue" popped out of one of the songs, a song called "Long Shot." And I started thinking about, what's that all about? Because I don't really know. It's just I'm playing with words and trying to find evocative things in songs that feel like something but aren't necessarily something concrete. So I decided that Mystery Glue was a better name than Dark Matter. And so I've just become a scientist. I play a scientist in the privacy of my own house, you see. I'm not really one. And I also thought, well, that's exactly how this band works. When we rehearse a new song, they don't know where I'm coming from with the song quite often and misrepresent it, I think, in their own minds a little bit. And people start playing stuff, and I think, what the heck are they playing? And then they look at me and say, well, what the heck are you writing here? And so we sort of come together, and the next thing you know, it's really starting to sound very, very good. And then we're recording, and voila, out of the speakers comes this great sound. And I say, that's the song. You're getting it, guys. One more take, So that's a kind of mystery glue that probably holds all bands together who work well together, are a good combination of musicians.
When you bring a song into those guys, how much better does it get for their contributions, their ideas?
Well, yeah, I write them, and usually just it's just me and a guitar and voice recording. Now, I might have written an album's worth of songs largely in a couple of months, and then I spend a year messing around with them, tinkering, making them better, So I put in a lot of work. Probably I'd rather record them 2 weeks later for spontaneity, but nobody can get... We all live in different parts of the globe. It takes a lot of organization and money to put us all in the same room together. So by the time I got there, I like the songs to be pretty strong where I want them to be. And I'm always amazed at how it shapes up when they start playing them. The whole thing explodes when they start to get it right.
That must be so fun and satisfying.
It is, yeah. By the time you get to mixing, you're really thinking, well, this is pretty hot. And I think we all like Mystery Glue. The sound of it is really very, very sweet. And I think it's pretty catchy stuff. And the band play very good, as always.
Yeah, I agree. You're sort of famous for having lots of influences, and I sort of hear all of that in this record. And it has that great sort of very classic sound. It's sort of reverent to your old sound, but it's not dated at all. It's very contemporary sounding. It just sounds like a rock band doing what they do with these great songs.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I don't... the past is there, but it doesn't interest me that much. It's always the next record. That's the only thing that... keeps me going. I mean, if I didn't write songs like this, I wouldn't be doing this. I just wouldn't be. It's whether the songs have pass the test from my point of view. That's what's important. As you know, I'm sort of quality control on them, and anyone else can decide what they want, you know. But I usually know from the band as they get into them that I'm still on the right track.
You were born 1950. You're like the perfect age to be a teenager when the Beatles were going crazy. Did that make you, I mean, I assume that's what made everybody want to play music.
It did. Well, for my generation, yeah, every kid in that age group. I was 12, coming on to 13, and couldn't have been around at a better time. You couldn't have been that age, becoming a teenager. It was, the wheel was being reinvented again. There was all that other stuff, the Elvis Presleys and, you know, all that stuff that came before, but that wasn't really hooked into our blood until the Beatles and the Stones, although they were, you know, young. They were teenagers, but it's breaking into their 20s and stuff, I suppose. So, but it seemed like our music, you know, it seemed like it had been invented for us. So that's when everybody decided you've got to grow your hair long and play a guitar instead of playing football, soccer as you call it, because that makes you, you know, you're covered in mud and it's raining all the time. It's England, right? So it's much better to play guitar, okay?
Where did you hear good records? I mean, I know that you love soul music. That's apparent. Where were good soul records to be heard in the early 1960s in England?
Well, it wasn't that easy. I think the pirate radios, and, you know, a radio was still a high-tech thing then. You know, when I was very young, it was these transistor radios, as they were called. They were made out of wood. You know, you've seen them on eBay and what have you. And they had, you know, some kind of BBC shows, I suppose, that played the old-fashioned music. And a lot of it was really good. You did Bing Crosby and all these stuff, Danny Kaye and Doris Day. All that stuff is still kind of rooted in my head with melodic structures. But the Beatles and the Stones and the American music, where they were getting the music from was obviously American records. And they were a bit older than us, as I say, that they were finding these records in obscure shops and stuff. But we'd hear Chuck Berry, for instance, on a Radio Caroline or one of those, Radio Luxembourg, and you'd only hear it in your parents' car when you're driving along and you turn a corner, and you'd get a bit of Chuck Berry, Johnny Be Good, and it would just blow your mind. And then you'd look at a Beatles song and see Roll Over Beethoven by some guy named C. Berry, and that's how you put it all together. And it was from those stations that you'd hear tiny bits. Now, when you're very young and impressionable and this music is absolutely boiling your blood, you only have to hear half a verse and it'll just expand your mind incredibly. I mean, that's all we used to get, little tidbits. So then from older friends, I had a few older friends, they'd say, you've got to go to this store and you'll find these records. So that's how we got into it. Very, very, by increments, really.
Yeah, I guess we take it all for granted now. You can have, you know, everything at the touch of a button, but it sounds like exciting, like finding illicit matter, sort of.
Well, it was, and some of it was illicit. I mean, my mother used to work in a place called the Officers' Mess in England. I was surrounded by British Army camps, a lot of Army, and she'd serve some teas there, and the officers came to chill out, basically, and get drunk and party in the evening. And she'd serve the teas in the afternoon, and they were always traveling, and they'd say, oh, you said your boy likes music, and they'd give her, oh, I can't take these, and they'd give her, like, Little Richard singles. Mm. And, you know, Tutti Frutti. It was pretty on the edge, really. We didn't understand it at that age, but you pick up on the sexuality and the excitement of it pretty quickly.
There's a great period in, you know, I think you left school at 16, and there's a period between then and when you sort of explode where you are working on your music, it seems like, the whole time, you know, your songwriting, your guitar playing, and you worked tons and tons of jobs, and you traveled around and played, you know, you traveled through Spain and Morocco and Gibraltar and just all over. What was the worst job you had, and how did that time influence what we hear now, what we know of Graham Parker now?
Oh, fantastic question. I did a lot of jobs. I think the first job I did when I left school, and yeah, we left school at 16 in those days, unless we were smart enough to take O-levels and things like that. And So my first job, I was really into wildlife and nature and stuff as a kid, because I grew up in the semi-country. There was army camps all around, but they owned a lot of land, so you were on a lot of wild land as a kid. Ran around in the woods on my own, totally free. It was great. And I was very into wildlife and David Attenborough shows, which were very rare in those days, called black and white. When we finally got a TV, it was about the time the Beatles came along, I think. Finally, the TVs entered the house. And so none of the teachers at school knew how you could get a job in that kind of line unless you were college educated, you know, and had degrees. But I found this place called the Animal Virus Research Institute, and I didn't really know much about it, but I became what's known as in the field of animal husbandry. In other words, I was breeding mice and guinea pigs for research. And It took about a year of realizing how disgusting this was and how you lose all your empathy for living things doing this job. And the people there were very, very small-minded people and all full of their own little intrigues and their own BS, you know. And I think that was probably the worst job. It was filthy, it was disgusting, it was cruel, and the people were stupid. So I think that will inspire you eventually to want to say something in this world, I think. I think it was things like that that sort of inspired me. But having said that, it took me a long, long time, because I was very lazy, even though I picked up a guitar at 13 and started pretending to play. I didn't learn properly until, you know, early 70s, when along with psychedelic music, the singer-songwriters were happening. James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and then Jackson Browne and people. And I could see that they could play songs on their own with just a guitar. And I started to practice finger picking and writing songs, the sort of lonely hippie on the road kind of songs. You know, you'd hear Neil Young, who sounded like, you know, he was 20-something or whatever, and he had the weight of the world on his shoulders. And that was very inspiring, to play those kind of lonely bedsits, you know, guy on the road, nobody understands him songs. So that kind of kicked me into it. And from there, then I sort of started to look back into my early soul roots, the things I liked, the Motown and the Stax. And next thing I know, I don't want to be one of these miserable singer-songwriter guys, you know, following people as good as James Taylor, because you're bound to be not as good as James Taylor, you know. So that's what kicked me into the first, you know, the Howling Wind record, which... Oh, I was 24 when I got a record deal, coming on 25. So it took me a long time, but by the time I got there, made Howling Wind, the record was about as good as anyone's first album could ever be.
Yeah, everyone loved that record, and it really did explode you. And I want to go back a half a step and say that you put an ad in Melody Maker, which it's so funny because the phrase "put an ad in Melody Maker" is in so many UK rockers' story of how they found musicians. It's amazing, you know.
I know. Well, I was, you know, I'd done all my traveling around, working in the petrol station just around the corner from my parents' house. After all my traveling on my own and with, you know, meeting all kinds of people all over different parts of the world, and I was just writing feverishly, and out in the suburbs there, people were just getting into Uriah Heep, and there was me sort of saying, no, short hair, straight trousers, got to revive rock and roll. That's what I've got to do with really literate songs. So people didn't understand it. So the obvious thing is an ad in the Melody Maker, hoping you'll meet some hip people in London. And that's basically what happened.
Yeah, and through that ad, you met some musicians. Then you met Dave Robinson, and he got you some demos, and they got played on Charlie Gillette's show, and you get signed to a record deal. And like you said, you meet Howlin' Wind with Nick Lowe producing it. Did that sound reflect, I mean, it seems to me to reflect very much so what was about to happen in this kind of big change in the music business. It's before the Sex Pistols, it's just before that, but it has that energy that is so different from that kind of dinosaur thing like Uriah Heep that you were talking about, you know?
Yeah, not to knock those bands. I mean, I'd been lying on the floor, staring at the ceiling, listening to Pink Floyd and King Crimson just about 2 years before. and then I turned into this totally different animal out of the blue. But all of that music, there was plenty of it that was good in its own way, but it was, to me, way out of date by about 73. I mean, Bowie had already happened, for goodness sake. That should have pointed everyone in a direction, and it pretty much did. Bowie, T-Rex stopped sitting cross-legged on the floor playing songs about stars and things, and started to rock, started to steal from Chuck Berry. So, you know, that was already in the air, and I was following through with that, really, more than starting something else. But 1976, me and the Rumour felt like we were in a field of one. There wasn't anything quite like it. But by 77, there was a lot of things that were a little bit like it.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it all changed. Let me remind everybody, we're talking to Graham Parker. Information about Mystery Glue, you can buy it at over at grahamparker.net, and you can also go there to see the dates of the tour that they are in the middle of tomorrow and Monday at City Winery in Chicago and all over the map, really, especially on the East Coast here and in the Highline Ballroom next Saturday here in New York City and in Newton, New Jersey later in the month. So like I said, check grahamparker.net for the dates and all that. So when you got these boys together, the Rumour, and put them in a room together. Some of these guys had been in bands that you'd heard of or probably seen, Ducks Deluxe and Brinsley Shorts. How apparent was it that, and as you said earlier, all these guys are great musicians, but there is something about this band where the sum of the parts is more than, yeah. You know, how quickly did you know?
Well, see, I didn't know anything about these bands, Brinsley Schwartz and Ducks Deluxe. I'd seen the name Brinsley Schwartz in the paper. I didn't know these people. And all of them, their careers were not going anywhere. I think some of them had been on, like, United Artists. They had a friendly guy in there who would sign some of those bands in London, even Ian Drury when he was Kilburn and the High Roads. But outside of London, they literally almost meant nothing, especially to me and my friend. We never heard of them. So, but when they played around me, when Dave Robinson, who became my manager, put them around me and we rehearsed, I thought, well, these guys understand my music. They seem to understand everything. They understand soul music, R&B, pop music, all the things that are out in the sticks they don't get at the moment. They think this is bubblegum, probably, because they've still got their hair long and lying on, you know, listening to, you know, this sort of plodding progressive rock. So I realized then that, okay, whatever happens, if this band isn't the one, I'm now linked up with people who can understand my music. You know what I mean? Mm. Finding Dave Robinson, who knew all these kind of musicians, he was really the key to it, and he heard my music and the light bulbs went off in his head. And so, you know, it seemed obvious to me this was a natural course.
So, like you said, the first record comes out. Was there some sort of backlash from the crowd that didn't want music to change and that came to you, or were you accepted? I mean, obviously there was a huge critical acceptance of how great this band was and this album was, but was there a backlash as well?
Well, no, it was basically when we went outside of London. See, punk hadn't come along yet, or that thing they called New Wave, and all those artists that go with it. That hadn't arrived yet. So we'd play outside of London and basically play to long-haired people sitting on the floor. They didn't understand why there were no long solos. Why isn't there a drum solo? That's what they were used to out in the sticks. And even when we went to Holland, you know, so there was just confusion, really, as to what we were. It was only handfuls of people here and there that understood that this is really happening, this is a cool thing. It just wasn't cool to most people, the way we were playing. So that's what we had to put up with. And then a year later, this punk thing happens, and I remember actually playing to audiences in the same places we played a year and a half ago, and now they were all spitting at me and leaping up and down because somebody said Graham Parker's the godfather of punk. And it's like, well, not really, guys, I'm not. But if you think so and you pack the gig out, I don't care, you know?
Now, let me remind folks, we're talking to Graham Parker here. It's Michael Shelley on WFMU. So those years must have been a lot of fun, a lot of pressure, I would assume. You know, you were on Mercury and then Arista. These are big, huge record companies in America. Was there pressure on you to have hit records?
There always was, yeah. My record sales were always disappointing for these people because in those days, you had to sell at least a million or it was a disappointment, you see. There were much bigger record sales. And, you know, when my Squeezing House Bach sold a quarter of a million or something in America, it was still a big disappointment. These days, if you sell a fraction of that, you go into the top 30.
Yeah.
You know, and you become on the cover of Rolling Stone, and they go on about the hit band who are really happening, and they've sold 50,000. So, you know, I'd routinely sell a couple of 100,000, and it was, like, pathetic. In those days, so the record company, the record companies then had more patience. They still kept you on for four albums. They still gave you the chance. So I've got to be grateful. I mean, people think I had a terrible time at record companies, but they never interfered with my work, because my manager and me, from the very first instance, before Howling Wind came out, said, we're not going to let them get involved. I said, right, I'm an artist. You know that record companies get involved with your songs. You take the money from them, and you make the record, and then you hand it in. So, I didn't have a bad time at record companies. It's just that Mercury were very old school, and they didn't know what was coming. They didn't see these 3.5-minute songs sung with attitude coming down the line, because punk hadn't come along, new wave hadn't. It wasn't there. So we were just stuck out there on our own, and they didn't really do anything. So there was all that argy-bargy, and I wrote that song, Mercury Poisoning. But to be honest, I had a great time up into the 90s getting major record deals with way too much money. It was good. I had a very, very good time.
So the rumor breaks up, and I'm not exactly sure what happened, but you stopped working with the rumor. I guess maybe you just got bored, and you never stopped working. It seems like you were always touring or finding a new way to present the music. You made another about 14 solo records. It's a lot of songs to write. Is it?
Yeah.
Tell me how that works. I mean, is it something you sit down and try to do, or is it more like lightning striking?
Well, it's something I try to do. It's, you have to kick yourself. I have to kick myself into it. It's not a casual thing for me, writing songs. It's a very difficult thing, and it's a powerful process where you kind of leave the earth for a little. It's like Earth to Graham, and you can't get me, you know. So I usually do it in sort of a systematic period of time. But that doesn't mean I'm not always coming up with ideas in my head. That's a continual thing. It's like a machine that I can't turn off. So that's there all the time, and then it's a case of kicking myself and saying, okay, stop thinking about it, stop writing notes, do it. And that's when I have to force myself to get into it. It's scary, because some of the ideas are good, but now can you turn it into a proper song? You know, that's the whole thing. That's the trick. It's the work process that's hard. It's always the same. It's always a bit mysterious.
2011, you reunited with the rumor for Three Chords Good, and you guys went on a tour. I think I know what led to it, but what led to this? I mean, some people thought it would never, ever happen.
Well, it was just an accident. It was me thinking it'd be a great idea to have Steve, the drummer, and Andrew, the bass player, and record an album with those two guys, because I've worked with them independently over the years since the rumor, but I have not work with them, in that sense, together for all those years as a rhythm section. And, Steve made a joke about the rest of the guys, and I went along with it and foolishly called everyone, and there it was. It was on. It was on, so we did that. We did Three Chords Good. And it was just a whim, really. There was no deep thinking behind it. But it turned out to be perfect timing in many ways. As you might know, we just after this happened, Judd Apatow, the filmmaker, got a hold of me and talked to me about this idea of having somebody in his movie who was playing themselves, and that turned out to be me. I got the job, and the rumor got in the movie, which is called This Is 40. So that's how we, all this came together by complete accident. It usually does.
Yeah, you guys are in that movie. You're movie stars.
Exactly. We are.
I have to point out, in 2013, there's a documentary made, Don't Ask Me Questions, by Michael Grimaglia.
Yeah.
And it's just a fantastic movie. If folks are curious about you, they must see this. There's lots of great live music footage, and the story of your life and your music is in this movie. And one of the big surprises of the movie for me was how funny the movie is. There's just a lot of laughter. I loved it.
Well, yeah, we doing that first album, Three Chords Good, we spent a lot more time laughing than playing, because it seemed sort of hilarious to us that we were all, you know, not young men. We're back in this studio trying to make a record. It was a curious kind of feeling, surreal. Your feet weren't quite on the ground. Somehow we made it through there with a pretty good record, Three Chords Good, and then now we've done this other one, and it was funny. I think if you don't have a laugh, a lot of people think, some people have done interviews with me and thought I was going to be some kind of miserable, you know, hard-nosed sort of guy. I thought there was always humor in my songs. And of course I was much more serious when I was 25. I wanted to just, you know, beat the world up with my music. But there was always a bit of humor there, I think, you've got to remember. There was a little sneaky bit of humor in my songs. And I think it's come out a lot more these days. And, you know, you say a joke on Twitter or something and people don't understand that you're a joker. It's all a laugh, really. Come on.
So tell me, in all these years you're working with these same guys, Brinsley and Martin and Bob and Steve and Andrew, I mean, you must know each other's jokes, you know, inside and out, and folks have children now, and it's just a different, like you said, the music business has changed so much. But I assume just the sort of, everyone's mellowed out a bit and just has more experience, and touring must be very different, but a lot of fun in some ways, I am assuming.
Well, it's the same thing. I could do without the touring and just be catapulted onto the stage, really. The rest of it, it's like enough already. But we get on okay. We do. We have a good laugh. It's that we got that English camaraderie and lots of jokes that come from things that we know from years and years ago. You know, lots of references to comedy shows and all this kind of stuff. We just know this stuff now. We've got routines down. And if you don't have that, boy, it would be a deeply miserable thing. There's nothing good about sitting in a people mover vehicle for 8 hours to get to a gig. There's nothing good about that. Let me tell you that now. But on the other hand, we have very comfortable hotels and we don't share rooms, so it's okay.
There is no substitute for the time, the history, you know, between human beings. And I think that's very evident on the new record, Mystery Glue. And I'm assuming it's evident on stage still. I'm going to go to the Newton show. You guys are playing in the Highline Ballroom on next Saturday, the 13th, and tonight and tomorrow at the City Winery in Chicago. And then all over the place, folks can check GrahamParker.net for information about where all those venues are, or to pick up a copy of the new record, Mystery Glue. Let's play the song Wall of Grace from Mystery Glue. I really like that song, something about it, but I'm not exactly sure what it is about. Can you tell me?
Yeah, it's typical of me to write something that's a really catchy pop soul number that, you know, might actually have chances of getting played, but then I obscure it by singing a lyric that is utterly incomprehensible to anybody on the face of the earth. It's basically about take a woman or a girl named Grace, and she has all her family photos on a long wall, a corridor in her house, and the boyfriend, there's new boyfriends in there or whatever he is, and looking at these family photos that go back quite a way, and thinking, what the heck's going on here? How do I fit in with all this? And her name is Grace, and that's the Wall of Grace.
It's almost literal.
It almost is literal, yeah. But it was fun playing with the words. I mean, her head is a mysterious place. Her heart's so big you can see it from space. It doesn't get better than that, baby. Come on.
A number one hit record, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Graham Parker, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. The new record's great, and really looking forward to seeing you and The Rumor on tour. And I hope the folks will come out for this, because it's not, you know, like you said, they all live on different corners of the globe now, and it's hard to get everybody in the same room.
It really is. And when we do the song Wall of Grace, you can join in instantly, because it also has do-do-do, do-do-do. Everybody understands that, right?
I'll be doot-doing in the audience. I can't wait. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
All right, Michael. Appreciate your time. Thanks. See you there.
Story kept changing, it kept rearranging. sleds, some pets that are long, long gone. Clutter right alive, Mama Hudson's wife, the lyrics from an Osso song. Yes, they overspilled, everyone was spilled, but I guess that's how life goes on. But the glue that holds them in place doesn't slip, slide, and has no taste. There's no bitterness in her face on a wall of grace. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do, do, do. Do, do, do. Oh. Do, do, do. Do, do, do. Yeah. Oh. I'm so glad you have made it there. It's hello. I say, I don't care, I belong up there, I belong.